Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. The blood still runs cold in a lot of us to see the images of people marching with torches in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, chanting racist slogans and worse. That was a clear indicator that white nationalism is very much alive and, at least for now, out of the shadows. Our next guest grew up in that world and decided in his 20s to leave it behind. R. Derek Black tells the story of their life and transformation in the book The Klansman's Son, My Journey from White Nationalism to Anti-Racism. R. Derek Black is on his way to a PhD in history at the University of Chicago. Derek uses they, them pronouns, and they have won humanitarian awards for speaking out against white nationalism for the last several years. Derek, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
You were almost like Ku Klux Klan royal family. How close is your family and David Duke, for example?
My family, both my parents and David, were extremely close. They all met when they were teenagers getting involved in the movement. And in calling it Ku Klux Klan royalty, like, almost unsells how big this movement is. It's really something that has stitched together all these different factions of white supremacist ideology, from Nazis to Klan to intellectual academics and tenured professors, and these different social scenes and social classes into one movement, really, over the last 50 or 60 years. And I grew up in the middle of a feeling of being in the midst of that kind of history that they had been building for decades by the time I was born.
Well, and so how old were you when you got to tell a national audience about your ideology?
I was 10 years old the first time I gave an interview, and it was a national television interview, and I felt like I was consenting to it. You know, my dad asked me over and over again on the trip up. I had grown up in Florida, and so we went to Chicago to film one of those daytime talk shows in the 90s. And I had seen him giving interviews in our house growing up about the white nationalist website that he had founded, the first one on the internet, and the community he was running. And as much as a 10-year-old could, I thought I believed the ideology. I wanted to advocate it. I wanted to make my parents proud. And watching that thing to write this book was just almost unbearable. I hadn't looked at it since that point, or the decade that followed it, when I kept giving more and more interviews, sort of growing up in the middle of it.
There's an interesting comparison that you make, though, at that point in the book, in telling the story about being on the Jenny Jones show. And it's that people from the Westboro Baptist Church, the ones who picket soldier funerals, were on the same show. And you thought you were different from them.
Yeah, I remember that. I had met both. My dad was giving an interview, and the daughter of the founder of the Westboro Baptist Church was also giving a talk on that show that day. And we both saw each other. Their family was there, and their kids were in the back, and I was in the back in the green room. We were interacting with each other, and we all saw each other as being completely unrelated. We thought it was a sort of a scam, almost, that this show was about hateful websites on the internet, and that we were all being put under the same umbrella. It was sort of a strange feeling to feel almost relieved at the time on the ride back from the show, I could draw this line. My dad didn't see himself as being part of the Westboro people. He thought they were crazy, and they thought he was crazy, and we weren't the same thing as them. And that sense that we were, I don't know, something special, something noble, like something that could feel right, was something that stuck with me, right along with the idea that my dad's ideology was one that separated everybody else from us. And I even then had this sort of conflict in me that I didn't want to be somebody who cut people off before I knew them. And it was just this sort of contradiction that I had to reconcile and eventually was not able to do.
Right, right. Well, that's the sense I really get in the book, is that you ultimately got to a kind of a physics problem. You had two worlds that were very different that couldn't exist within your body or your mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's strange. I think people sometimes ask me for sort of counterfactuals, because I really believed in that ideology from the time I was 10, giving an interview advocating for it, and in a way that I can look back and say, I think it's wild to put a 10-year-old in an interview and assume, no matter how many times you ask them, that that's consensual. But I also founded a children's website for white nationalism at the time. I ran it, and I kept giving interviews, and I kept advocating for it into my teens. And As I grew, I talked to tenured faculty members who were white supremacists, who I look back on, and it's amazing how they were able to convince themselves of something that is so obviously disprovable as the idea of race as some kind of biological category, when it's not definable biologically, it's social. But I bolstered myself with those kind of facts, and I tried to reconcile the idea that this was some ideology that I could say was true, and that's what had to make it feel okay for how bad it felt to separate myself from anybody.
R. Derek Black is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of The Klansman's Son, My Journey from White Nationalism to Anti-Racism. You mentioned your father's website. He started Stormfront Online, and you started a junior version of Stormfront. What did you want to do with it?
Yeah, it was Stormfront for Kids. I had created it, and I wrote this little essay about how I had left school because I was in public school up until I was 9 years old, and when my parents took me out of school, and I was homeschooled after that, and I was genuinely very isolated. But I didn't necessarily feel lonely. I felt like I was being given more time and more space to lean into my family's movement ideology. I set up that website, and in addition to giving interviews, I started traveling with my dad around the country, going to conferences, because the white nationalist movement is much broader than I think a lot of people recognize. It's one where people don't look a certain way. You know, it's not that you can recognize people who consider themselves white nationalists. They're from every social strata. There's lots of white-collar people. There are people have lots of education, particularly the ones who are able to travel and have disposable income. And so we would go to these conferences and hotel banquet rooms that required suits and ties and had registration fees and big dinners. And I could just feel, this isn't what everybody says. This is not, when they say it's not hateful, they must mean it. You know, they genuinely mean this thing that they actually just care for other people. And it's almost incidental how terrified everyone is of what they want in the world.
That's interesting. So it was you were around people who seemed like nice people to you because they were nice to you. It sounds like you guys had a fairly close-knit community there.
Yeah, it was. It was something that gave everybody within it this strong sense of identity and purpose. It was something that the ideas of white nationalism are extreme and they are marginal. And the whole goal of this movement, which I don't want to downplay the extreme violence that comes out of it, which is not some separate movement. It's the same ideology, but the part that I was in was one that was committed to politics and was committed to seeing themselves as being very intellectual and thoughtful and genteel and never using racial slurs or never using vulgarity at all, sort of seeing themselves as being above the hateful, low-class sort of rhetoric. You know, that's how they saw themselves. And it was this world that people came to because the ideas were latent in the rest of America, like the ideas of anti-Semitism, racism, anti-immigration, like sort of resentment, are things that existed in more low-key ways in broad sections of America, and that's what gave it its energy, because sometimes people would come into it and they could amplify their views. They could start with something much more subtle and then become much more extreme and dedicate their lives to it, and then other times, just the fact that they were saying these things, they were the only people who were willing to say openly racist things and keep that message alive, allowed people to at least point to them and say, okay, they're carrying the banner. It's somebody is saying it's acceptable.
You have a really good tight paragraph on white supremacy, society's undercurrent, you call it. I mean, do you think it's completely woven into the fabric of our society?
Well, I mean, it depends on exactly how you think about it. It's objectively woven into our society in the fact that you can look around and anyone born into our society can look around and see deep social inequalities. Even just looking at wealth, race is not predictive of people's behavior. It's not predictive of crime or intelligence or any of the other ridiculous things that white nationalists try to claim that it's this biological category. It's really not. There are human sort of genetic common groups in the world, and they're not race. Race is something that was created historically in America because through incidents of immigration, skin color and sort of face shape was something that looked different between different groups in the colonies. And race was created as this way to make cheap labor. And over the centuries, we defended this. People justified this inequality. And white nationalists, one thing that I realized going back and trying to just understand how do people get to this place is that they grew up in that same society. They look around and they see the fact that being born, seen as someone who's white, is much more likely to land you with more wealth, generally more opportunities, not universally, but just as a likelihood of the base rate than if you were born as somebody who's black or not white. And they look at that world and they needed to justify it. They didn't want to feel like they were living some, as the beneficiaries of some kind of social crime. Some people look and say, oh, this is unjust and we need to change it. And then others look and say, I don't want to be blamed for this, and I need it to be to make sense to me.
Our Derek Black is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of The Klansman's Son, My Journey from White Nationalism to Anti-Racism. Is white nationalism the same as white supremacy, or is there an additional color or shade to it?
I use the word white nationalism or white power to distinguish the fact that this is a particular social movement, that it has a history that goes back into the 1950s, and members of this movement see themselves as having this common social history. They have some of the same heroes. They have read a lot of the same books and articles. They have similar talking points. A lot of them know each other. And white nationalism is a movement that's relatively decentralized. It's not one with particular membership organizations, and some of that is intentional because of the violence that comes out of it to remove the responsibility, at least the legal responsibility, for the massive violence that has been perpetrated by members of this movement. And so I use that term to differentiate from just white supremacy as like the idea of racism. I don't want people to think that this movement that I grew up in the center of is just people with racist beliefs. It's something that is distinguishable, that uses a lot of the common beliefs that come from white supremacy, but has its own history, its own intellectual strain, its own arguments, its own worldview that is distinct and has a goal, has like a political and social revolutionary goal.
So the ideas that you grew up with then, and again, your father, Don Black, was well known in the movement and started the Stormfront website. If you guys had achieved some of the goals of the movement as you saw them and gotten the kinds of candidates you wanted to get elected, what did you see would have been the result?
The goal of white nationalism fundamentally is to overthrow society. The it's not one with a narrow vision. Like, they view the world as in need of this dramatic racial segregation, and they want countries around the world to be based around this idea of race that they find so compelling. And beyond that, they're deeply focused on the idea of a Jewish conspiracy, that all Jewish people are involved in promoting anti-racism and civil rights, not only in America, Europe, and other countries. And so this world is deeply conspiratorial, based in fake science and false ideas, but is one that motivates people and allows them to justify anything. Like, they think they're the victims. And so some factions of this movement commit atrocities like mass violence. Others are more focused on politics and trying to win election. But their goals are all deeply revolutionary. They want to abolish the 14th Amendment. They want to end immigration. They want to see America segregated in a way that some of them are willing to name the horror that it would require to do that in a country that has never had any racial separation like that, that we're trying to imagine. And some of them are really, really clear about the ways that they want to force everybody to separate.
We're coming up on a break in about 2 minutes here. You walk us down the road of the media fascination in the book, frequently coupled with public revulsion, that, gee, white nationalists seem normal enough. And why do you think it is so important for us to keep that in mind?
Well, it's because looking and seeming normal enough isn't worth commenting on. I think that's part of their strategy, is to seem normal. And it's not a fake out. They grow up in the same society. Like I said before, their beliefs exist in a much more latent way in broad parts of America, and they've come to more extreme versions of them. And when they are showing that they buy clothes at the same outlet stores and watch the same movies and go to the same chain restaurants, that shouldn't surprise people, because it almost makes the case that racism itself is not wrong. It's like the kinds of people who are espousing it should be uneducated or not have very much life experience or not have traveled or whatever. If racism can be perpetrated and believed by anybody, And that's kind of the point. It is believed by people from every strata of America. And so when they're trying to build up their movement, that's exactly the message they're trying to give. And I really try to emphasize that interviews and media focus on it should not do that, should not focus on, ah, this is just so mundane. Isn't that odd? What's odd about it is that racism is so mundane.
Our Derek Black, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Their book is The Klansman's Son, My Journey from White Nationalism to Anti-Racism. We'll pick up the conversation on the other side of a break. This is the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. We'll be back. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest is R. Derek Black, who is on his way to a PhD in history at the University of Chicago. Derek grew up in basically white nationalist royalty. His mother was once married to David Duke before she married his father, Don Black. And this is the world that Derek grew up in. And he tells the story about living in it and getting away from it in the book, The Klansman's Son, My Journey from White Nationalism to Anti-Racism. So we were talking before the break about the banality, these are people living everyday lives, but they're white supremacists. I mean, ultimately, should we realize there is more white racism than we generally think in America?
Yes, and I think we should sort of recognize that it's not strange or exceptional. I think there's this sense that I've encountered at some point in my life that white supremacy or racism will always be recognizable because the person will have gang tattoos or a shaved head or will visibly look different from everyone else. And I think that's really something that, like we were talking about before the break, benefits the white nationalist movement that is trying to mainstream these ideas. And it's just false. It's not that those are aspects of this movement, for sure, but it's not one that defines it. It's not one that they always lean into when they're trying to gain more widespread support from mainstream people in every part of this country and also internationally.
The language of the movement, Stormfront, soldiers, I mean, how literal is the thinking of battles?
They all imagine an apocalyptic future. The idea is that they have foreseen that race wars and conflicts are just inevitable. They think that white people all in their hearts want separation. Sometimes they think that everybody wants separation. This belief in an anti-Semitic conspiracy is one that justifies the fact that they are being manipulated, and they believe movies are trying to convince people to be anti-racist rather than people wanting to live in a less unjust society. And so their view is that they are foreseeing this breakdown of society and that they're trying to sort of prepare for it. When they talk about violence or militias, they, even if they're not choosing it now, they almost universally have a sense that there is a coming conflict that they're sort of preparing for. I think sometimes I almost think of it like the Terminator movies, this idea that there's this inevitable war coming. Like, that is the mindset that they all live in, and it's how they're able to both feel so fulfilled by it as an ideology and as a feeling of being in a community of people who are the only ones who recognize this future, but also how almost anything is justifiable.
Do they think of themselves as defenders, though, rather than people going on offense?
Yeah, they see themselves as the people against the wall. The arguments that are primary that I really helped promote in my teenage years and I'm ashamed of are talking about genocide. Like, the word is genocide that they argue and say is happening to white people, right? And by that, they don't even mean violence. They just mean immigration and dating and people having kids without trying to maintain some kind of racial boundary. And they view that as this death to their people. And so this idea of death is just so common, so universal, and sort of stalks all of their stories. And that's the way they see themselves as being defenders, as being able to justify anything, because they feel like if they don't, then everything is lost.
So how did that affect you in your formative years, this sense of fatalism that, you know, things were going to collapse and you're going to have to kind of fight your way out of the rubble or something?
I mean, it was terrifying. It was this, when I look back, it was a a scary childhood at times, not because my family were scary people themselves. Like, they were quite gentle and quiet, and the spaces that I went into typically didn't feel violent or dangerous, although sometimes that wasn't true. There was always dangers of violence, people threatening the house who were on the other side of the movement, or people within the movement fighting. And, you know, violence was never very far away from me, nor was the fact that people my dad had known his whole life, including him, had been involved in and experienced violence. So something that was very scary to me when I was a kid. And I also took it as part of the sense of sacrifice. You know, something that I thought they all felt like they were sacrificing their security, their safety, their jobs, their reputations for this thing they thought was bigger, which is why once I got to college, after having run for office and run a radio show on my dad's website as a teenager, I believed, you know, this is something that I thought I had facts for, and it was something that I thought was so meaningful. And so I had been homeschooled, but once I developed these relationships at this college, it surprised me more than I expected it to, that developing relationships with people who were Jewish or students of color in a way that didn't feel initially new, because I had always tried to not wall myself off from people. But at college, I wasn't able to just go home at the end of the day. And when people did eventually find out about my background, because I had kept it from them for the first semester, I was really faced with this question of, how can I be somebody who says that I care about these people who I'm very close to, and people in a broader sense in America and society and the world, and also be deeply tied to this ideology? I initially answered it with, well, you know, I have all these facts, and so if it feels bad, that can't change it. But then through engagement with people who did invite me in addition to people who ostracized me on campus over years, I had to unpack these arguments and ultimately condemned it at the end of that experience.
Well, yeah, the sense of you really having your horizons expanded, particularly in person-to-person relationships when you got into higher education, and unlike your homeschooling, this is around other people who come from different backgrounds, different homes. It's clear. I mean, so you know, you and your family, though, you're real smooth media figures, you and all your mentors. I mean, but you know, being called a rising Hitler and a stain on Florida, and away from the cameras, how did those make you feel?
Really did make me feel bad. I felt like it was a sacrifice I was willing to make. It was one that I justified to myself as an adolescent and a teenager, and as well as, you know, hate mail and being vilified and having to embrace this idea of being just a horror to people. This idea of, like, a child advocating white supremacy was something that helped advance this movement, that my parents recognized helped advance the movement. And it personally felt like a great loss. Like, I tried to respond to that, especially throughout my adolescence, by thinking that I could divide myself. I could have two websites. You know, I started a personal one before I started a white nationalist page. And on that one, I just posted about Spider-Man and tornadoes and wrote this blog in the 90s for what I thought other kids. And I increasingly recognized that the white nationalist world was taking over. It was becoming my whole life, and I embraced that. I thought, this is inevitable, this is meaningful, it's significant for my family. But it always felt like something that was this great loss, that I was not able to maintain this world, this version of myself that felt more true and sort of soft and open to people.
R. Derek Black is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Their book is The Klansman's Son, My Journey from White Nationalism to Anti-Racism. So I hear you are at college learning new things, but mostly learning to live with other people who didn't embrace your philosophy, far from it. And at some point, you had to admit to friends who you were or who you had been. Did that come from you, or were you outed?
I was outed. I had kept it from people initially, and that wasn't unusual. It was sort of my behavior in most spaces. And people would often find out eventually because I was on television. I had a high profile. I was easily Googleable. But they also were typically, before that college experience, willing to somewhat let it pass, say, this is uncomfortable. And I would say I didn't really want to talk about it, wanted to talk about our common interests. And it was at that college, at New College of Florida, a public liberal arts college, that I realized it was not going to be like that. It was going to be a space where people were deeply committed to social justice and anti-racism, and making it be a space that felt like it accorded with those values was something that was deeply significant to people. And so when I was outed, and I had felt it coming, I think I'd planted a magazine in the gym with an article about me because I just could not bear the fact that I had started all these relationships with people and had slowly come to realize that this felt like I was betraying them. It felt like I was deceiving them in a way that I had never experienced before, and I just couldn't bear the idea. So I was studying abroad when I was outed, and when I came back, it was to this campus that was completely changed and was debating about what to do with me.
You were such a pariah on campus at New College. Why did you stay?
I didn't want to run away. I mean, on one hand, I had gone there thinking I just wanted an education. I didn't think that I wasn't trying to run away from facts. I thought I was open to somebody who was, or I was somebody who was open to being considered wrong, but I thought I had thought about my facts. And so I wasn't worried about feeling like my ideology was fragile. And I had, in fact, and I think I recognize this mostly in retrospect, but I knew it at the time too, made these relationships. And so I cared about this community. And my reaction to so many people who I knew and respected and understood how smart they were, saying that I was not only wrong, but ignorant and hateful and advocating stupid things and also had deceived them, made me have this initial reaction of, is there some way that I can make you understand? You know, is there some way that I can reconcile? Is there a misunderstanding here? Because I don't want to see myself as somebody who's harming people. I didn't see myself as somebody who's harming people. I was working very hard to sort of wrestle with that cognitive dissonance. And going back felt like the choice that was most whole with myself. I didn't expect to change my beliefs, but I also didn't want to see myself as somebody who was running away.
And you tell us about some remarkable friends you made. Allison is the one, well, it's the name you use in the book. Wow, what patience. And it seems like you ultimately could not live in her world and your old one.
Yeah, Allison was roommates with Matthew, who hosted Shabbat dinners every Friday in his dorm, which are the dinners hosted by observant Jews to begin the Sabbath every Friday night. And white nationalism is deeply anti-Semitic. And I, at that point, I had more or less mostly abandoned this idea of anti-Semitism. So I often wonder how much I was already rethinking my beliefs even then. But I showed up to this space, the only one that was welcoming me on campus. And I thought people were going to attack me, you know, try to argue my beliefs at me. And I was willing to argue. I felt like I was good at arguing. And they didn't initially, you know, they didn't bring it up. They just talked about other things. And it was just being there that was challenging me. And Allison was somebody who I met through those dinners. And she recognized that nobody on campus was having those conversations. There were people who were taking the position of ostracism, of trying to make this campus be a place that was safe for the people who felt victimized or felt in danger from white nationalism and what I represented. But there was nobody who was sitting with me week after week. And so her initial question, after she got to know me, after initially boycotting those dinners, was just to ask me if I was willing to explain the sort of contradiction of going to these dinners and being friends with people who it seemed like my ideology didn't accept, and yet I saw myself as somebody who fit in there. And I said yes. And she recognized that I saw myself as being held by these facts. And she was a person who recognized that these facts don't seem right, that you've learned from all these old men and these tenured professors. And, you know, I can argue about facts. And so we started with that. Over years, we argued about statistics and crime and IQ and just the basis for race and all these things that white nationalists justify. And I had to admit bit by bit that those pieces of evidence didn't work. They weren't there anymore. And then the conversations turned much more emotional. It was that, how can I say that I am a good friend to a community of people who I then go talk to my family on the radio and advocate an ideology that says they don't belong? And that was the thing that really ultimately led me to the place of recognizing that it had never been about being the most rigorous with my beliefs, trying to always make sure they were factual and just being tied by truth. It had been something that tied me by my identity, by my sense of not wanting to lose my community. And so the last choice was the one that I couldn't just go silent. I had advocated this for so many years. I needed to explain at least that I condemned it. But that came along with separating myself, my family. You know, I lost connections with most of my family, and most of the relationships that I had had up until I was 21 years old ended at that point. And so my lesson when I look back on that is just how interchangeable the idea of changing your mind about something fundamental to who you are, how that is exactly the same thing as the idea of changing the community of people that you care about.
It's an amazing story. It is The Klansman's Son, My Journey from White Nationalism to Anti-Racism. It's written by R. Derek Black, who is on his way to a PhD in history at the University of Chicago. Derek, thanks so much for sharing this with us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me today.
And that's it for today's exchange. JeffExchange.org is our website. All interviews are archived there. Angela Decker of JPR News is our senior producer. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.